And very happy that today we are going to hear from the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, who is visiting Minnesota. And we do have a couple of other members, and we can introduce ourselves if you'd like. I'll start to my right with Senator Hall. Senator Hall.
Hi. I'm Senator Dan Hall. I covered 56th District, which is Savage, Burnsville, a little bit of Lakeville.
Good morning. I'm Senator Eric Pratt. I represent Senate District 55, which is northern Scott County, so the communities of Prior Lake, Shakopee, and Jordan.
Well, thank you both for being here. Ms. O'Connor?
Oh, I'm Ann O'Connor, Communications Director from the Department of Commerce.
And we do have some other folks that we've invited to sit at the table with us that are very strong advocates and help in this this area as well. And I'll forego those introductions, and we'll just get right to the folks who are at the table, and welcome. And please proceed with the information that you have to share with us. And thank you for doing this today.
Thank you for having us. I don't know if this is on or, but
it is on.
I'm just hoping for the people on the phone that they, I don't know if they're probably in the mic, hear me. Well, thank you for having us. The CFPB is glad to be in Minnesota today. Glad to be here presenting. We wanted to talk a little bit. We wanted to give you an overview of who we are, what we do, and why we do it, and how we do it. And we've got representatives here from different offices to talk about their respective work in those offices. And so with that, I will proceed. Just a little bit of history. Before the CFPB, there was no one federal entity that covered consumer financial products. The states handled that through the AGs, the attorney generals, and the state bank supervisors. There were seven different federal agencies who had a hand in that, but not one solely purpose to it. The Dodd-Frank Act created this, the CFPB, which is solely purposed for consumers of financial products. And the reason we do this, the reason we were created, is a couple reasons. I want to sum up three of the four on the slide, is that one in five Americans over the age 65, so we do have an office dedicated for older Americans, are victims of a financial scam. And, you know, we're all going to get older someday. I'm going to be in that age range someday, and I'm going to want help. And I'm going to want to be kept apprised of what's going on. And so that's one of the reasons we were created. Another, we have an office for students. And 29% of young people between the ages of 22 and 29, which is our student range, report not going to school, not continuing their education, because they're in debt. And that debt weighs a lot on local budgets, on national budgets, more than you'd think.
Excuse me, I'm just going to interrupt. I need you to state your name for the tape. We are being taped. Sorry.
Oh, for the tape. My name is Jared Esselman.
And your title?
I'm the coordinator for intergovernmental affairs at the CFPB.
All right. Thank you. I'm sorry to interrupt.
Sorry, and I'll have everybody else do the same as well.
That would be helpful.
And then lastly on this slide, 50% of claims that we have on debt collectors cite harassment. Now, that's been illegal for a while. Nobody's really been pressing down on it. But I don't know if you ever had a call from a debt collector, but they can be pretty harsh. And some of the stories we get are fairly harsh. So our mission is to create a 21st century agency. One of the things that I was told when I started the CFPB was, don't do things just because that's the way it's always been done. And that's our mentality. That's the way we move forward. We want to move forward with new technology, with innovations, and with data-driven analysis. We want to look at the numbers. We don't want to just get the feel, but we want to look at the numbers. What's the hard data behind this? And we have very good research teams. We do a lot of research, and we really try and dig into the source of issues. Our vision is simple. We want a fair trading market, a fair financial market for consumers in America. We all know that more information there is in a market, the more competition there is in a market, the better that market, the healthier that market, and the fairer that market. And so we have a couple of statutory objectives, and I won't read through the whole slide, but we do want to empower consumers. This is our goal. We want to be able to empower consumers to be able to make sound and healthy financial decisions. And that's really what we're working toward every step of the way. How can we help consumers make sound, healthy financial decisions? And so I wanted to tell you how we work, because one of the first things that we do is we want to educate these consumers. In order to make those sound decisions, you have to have information, you have to have knowledge. And our first line of defense against abusive practices, deceptive practices, unfair practices is an educated consumer. You can't be taken if you know as much as the other guy. If you are an educated consumer, an informed consumer, then you can make those sound decisions. So that's our first line of defense. Secondly, we enforce regulations. We supervise banks, non-banks, $10 billion in assets or more. And then we also have the larger rule, the... What's the name of it? Larger participant rule. That's the word I'm looking for. And then, like I said, we do a lot of research. We study, we gather and analyze data, and we make decisions on regulations based on that data. And so I just wanted to give you a structure of the divisions in the CFPB. We have consumer, and I have this backwards. It's engagement and education, but it should be education and engagement. Supervision, enforcement, and fair lending. Research, markets, and regulations. Our legal division, which is internal. External affairs, which is the outward-facing division of the Bureau. Operations, and within operations, we're going to focus on one, consumer response, because it's a fairly unique, not fairly, it is a very unique office within the agency that most other agencies don't have, and is one of our strongest pegs of the stool, so to speak. So among other things, we do write rules, we do supervise, we take consumer complaints, and we respond to those complaints, we track those complaints, we research consumer behavior. Later, Dubas will tell you about our efforts to promote financial education. And we also monitor not only the markets, but also the regulations and laws that affect those markets. And so with that, without further ado, I'll hand it over to Dubas. And she'll talk to us. This is Dubas Coryell from the Office of Financial Education. And she'll take it from here.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you. Good morning. Is this on?
Yes.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you so much for the opportunity to present. My name is Luis Correal, and I'm with the Office of Financial Education, the Outreach and Strategic Partnerships Coordinator for the office. And what I'm going to do first is I'm going to give you an overview of the Consumer Education and Engagement Division, and then I'll talk to you a little bit about what we're doing in the Office of Financial Education. So our goal is to provide consumers with information, and our challenge is to make sure that consumers make affirmative action, make decisions based on that knowledge. We do have six offices in the Division of Consumer Education and Engagement, and we'll talk about how these offices are trying to achieve that, providing information to consumers so they can make informed decisions. We have the first two offices are the Office of Financial Education and the Office of Consumer Engagement. Those two offices sort of cut across the division. The Office of Consumer Engagement is responsible for our property, digital properties, our website, social media. And the other four offices are targeted to specific populations. We have the Office of Service Member Affairs, the Office for Older Americans, the Office for Students, and the Office for Financial Empowerment. And I'm not going to get into detail because we're going to have representatives from those offices telling you a little bit more about what they do. So I'm going to focus on the Office of Financial Education. That Frank mandated that we educate 300 plus million Americans, and it didn't give us any specific mandate as the other offices. So what we did is we divided our strategy in five areas. The first one is conducting research. For those of you that are familiar with the field of financial education, there are a lot of programs out there. There are thousands of programs out there. And the evidence is mixed. Some of them are effective. Some of them are not. And also, there is not enough rigorous evaluation. So what we are doing, we are evaluating two programs that combine financial coaching with financial education. And the idea is to determine what's effective for whom and under which circumstances. And we're doing, we're using RCT studies. We're also developing metrics for success. So we're trying to determine what does financial well means. And what we're doing is, in the field of financial education, we have been saying for years that people should know about compound interest. And yes, that's a very important concept. But do knowing about compound interest help you make better decisions? So that's what we're trying to determine. We're actually coming up with hypotheses and trying to identify if it's a knowledge, is it behavior, is it context, what really changes behavior. So we're trying to develop hypotheses, and then we're going to be testing those. And we hope to get to have results in early 2014 about this research. And we really feel that we're filling critical gaps in the field of financial education, which really will help the field improve the levels of financial education. The second strategy is promoting innovation. Again, we're trying other strategies. We're using behavioral economics, and what we're trying to do is sort of like identifying what are the behavior impediments as to why people don't make certain decisions. Just to give you an example, I mean, we're not telling people you have to plan for retirement because that's a daunting task. But what we're trying to do is determining when you start a job and you get all the paperwork to sign up for your 401k, why don't you do it? So we're trying to determine what is the behavioral impediment. So we're going very, very specific. And there are other strategies that we're doing with this project, but just to give you an example of the kind of research that we're trying to do. And then the idea is to develop behavioral tools to help you sort of like advance that behavioral impediment. We conducted a process to recruit partners, and we're in the process of developing the tools as we speak. The other area is educating consumers. We are mandated by legislation to create content, but we're trying to do it in a very strategic way because, as I mentioned before, there is a lot of stuff out there. And just to give you a specific example, have a rule that protects people who send money home, and that rule became effective on October 28th. So what we did, we worked very closely with our team of research, markets, and regulation to develop an education campaign around the rule. The education campaign was launched on October 28th and is running through January 6th because the holidays is sort of like the biggest volume for people sending money home. So we developed a campaign in five languages: English, Spanish, Tagalog, Chinese, French Creole, and Spanish. Did I say it Spanish before? And the idea was to sort of like use our tools in the Office of Financial Education to inform the public about our rule. The next area is educating youth. Back in April, we launched our K-12 strategy, and the idea is to start educating people at an early age. It's important, so we sort of have certain policy recommendations, and we're working to develop tactics to achieve those areas. And the last area is coordinating with people who are working on the ground. We had an opportunity to meet with a lot of the financial education providers and other providers here in Minnesota in the last 2 days. It has been great because we cannot do this job by ourselves. We have to do it by leveraging resources and by working with people who are on the ground and people that consumers trust. So we do that by working with local, state, and other organizations. We also coordinate very closely with the federal government. We're part of the Financial Literacy and Education Commission, which is a statutory commission created by Congress and is composed of 22 federal agencies. The Dodd-Frank put the director of our agency as the vice chair of that commission. So that's also another way for us to coordinate efforts. So I just wanted to mention, so that's sort of the strategy of the Office of Financial Education, and we work very closely with our colleagues in other offices within the Bureau. And I just wanted to highlight this tool, which is a tool of that was created to inform consumers. It has more than 1,000 basic questions, financial questions. So we invite you to share this with your constituents because it's a very good tool. It provides answers, and if someone goes through the tool and doesn't find the answer, they can let us know. Or if they're looking for another question, another topic, they can let us know, and we'll make sure to provide that information. Our experts in the Bureau review the information that gets posted on this tool, so we're ensuring that whatever is posted is very accurate. And now I also wanted to highlight, as I said, part of what we do is to create content, but we have done that in a very strategic way. So we do have a page on gsa.gov where we have a series of plain language one-pagers or two-pagers to help the public understand financial topics, and wanted to make sure that I highlight that because you can order publications for free. And wanted to highlight that we have our website in Spanish as well. And now I'll turn it over to my colleague, Will, in the Office for Students. Will Seeley, is he on the line?
Hi, thank you so much. It's really a pleasure to speak on the call today. I wish I could be there in person. Unfortunately, I'm back in D.C. Working on a number of issues related today to a recent rule we put out, but I'll get more to that later. The Office for Students is very much dedicated to similarly the other functions in the Bureau, working on education and engagement of a variety of people who are invested in higher education and trying to pursue a path where they can gain the education that they need for a lifelong success. And unfortunately, as we look more and more closely into the costs of college, the economy and the economics around the financial decisions that one makes to choose the path of entering higher education, we're acknowledging that there are growing trends that are sometimes quite alarming, and do a lot of work around educating people about the information they need to know about how to take the necessary steps to be able to go to college, but then also once they've taken out loans or financing for that decision, how they can best manage the debt that they're taking on and be able to pay it off over the life of the loan. One of the things that our team is very committed to is an assessment of the student lending market more broadly. A few weeks ago, we put out a review of the student lending market. We're now looking at what is a $1.2 trillion market, which is just second after the mortgage markets, and has recently passed the auto lending and credit card markets. We have numbers that just came out today, actually, from the Department of Education, which reveal that there are approximately 40 million borrowers of that $1.2 trillion of debt. Many of these borrowers who graduated more recently graduated into one of the harder economic situations where it was very, very difficult to obviously pay back their debt. And then as due to sort of the federal budget process, we've seen a number of cuts across different states that have impacted a number of schools. And so as that burden has gone from the state gone to the school, it's a lot of times we're seeing from consumers who are writing to us and our reports on the economy, we're seeing that families are bearing that burden and then students as well. So students who are borrowing are now borrowing more. We saw the class of 2012 close to those who borrowed were close to around $30,000 of student debt per borrower. And that is the highest number it's ever been. It's only increasing each year. And so as this continues to get more expensive, we spend a lot of time talking directly to consumers and then working with a number of organizations and entities that do so as well to provide as much information as we can over that process. We both target three specific areas of stakeholders in this process: those who are looking to eventually go to college, and this includes all young Americans that are interested in doing so, as well as family members and anyone else interested in that process. Those who are currently in school, and then those who've recently graduated and are paying back debt. And as we target each of those three stakeholders, we try to spend as much time as possible thinking through what are the decisions that have to be made, what are the pros and cons and the benefits and the information that is most important. Specifically for those who are looking to go to college, we've developed what is a very unique tool that's offered on our website, and that's called the Paying for College tool. In many ways, this was an agency-wide project. We worked with a number of teams to put this together, and it's the cost comparison tool allows you to put different institutions that you're interested in pursuing side by side. So you could compare a state school that might be close by to your home to another school that you've gotten into that might be a private institution, and trying to compare what are the true costs. What is the actual debt that you would be taking on if you went to these schools, so that you could really be able to make an apples-to-apples comparison, which has unfortunately been so hard to do previously. We worked with the Department of Education to make sure that all of the data and all of the information there complies with the work that they've done already, building on the backs of their good work. And it's something that we found from a number of consumers is quite helpful. We have almost 500,000 consumers going there pretty regularly. So we're talking quite a large number of people viewing and using this tool. We hope to continue to promote it going forward as we update it as best as possible with new information and tools coming in. Through that portal on our website, we also have a number of action guides and information for consumers and borrowers and students and families to help guide them through that process in addition to the tool itself. So plenty of resources to check out if you have time. Within that same portal as well, we also, on the flip side, want to make sure that those who are already borrowing have the information and tools and resources they need to make sure that they're addressing the debt that they've taken on in the way that works best for them. So what we have, it's called the Repay Student Debt Tool. It's essentially a thought tree tool that allows you to enter in your information and based on a series of questions that we ask you, customizing and figuring out what is your unique experience. Do you have federal loans? Do you have private student loans? What are the differences between the two? One of the things that many borrowers don't realize is the number of protections that are inevitably built into federal student loans that many private student loans don't offer. With fixed interest rates for federal student loans, many private student loans have fluctuating rates, similar to what we've seen in the mortgage market. There are a number of issues there, and we also acknowledge there are a number of protections that homeowners have for their mortgage that aren't actually the same in the private student lending market. In addition to all of that, like every other team here, that we put a lot of effort on answering direct questions from consumers in our Ask CFPB portal. If anyone wants to know exactly what is the difference between federal or private loans, what should I consolidate my federal loans into private student loans? What's a scenario where that would make sense for the borrower? We address all of those in very plain language, attempts to give that information up, and we find that a lot of organizations have found that on our website quite useful. I think we're actually close to over 150 questions that we've answered through SCFPB, so we really try to provide as much information as is useful. And then looking forward, one of the things we just did this last week, we issued a rule where we are now looking at servicing some of the largest overseeing some of the largest student loan servicers. And in doing so, we will be monitoring the market for any risks or potential harms to consumers, and keeping an active eye in this space, and actually we'll start looking much more closely into that. We have a briefing call later this afternoon at 1 p.m. where we'll be going through that, but a lot of the materials and information, including the rule itself, is available on our website under the newsroom platform where we put out a press release on it. In addition, we work very closely with Rohit Chopra, who's the student loan ombudsman. He has a very unique role at the agency as essentially directly reporting on student lending issues and making sure that anything that comes up that is a concern is brought to the attention of Congress, to the director of the CFPB, the director of the Treasury, and the Department of Education. So we take our role very seriously in terms of any potential harms to consumers and student loan borrowers being addressed as quickly and as seriously as possible. If you have any questions for me, I'm always available at william.seeley@cfpb.gov. Or you could always reach out to me directly at 202-435-9691, which is my direct line.
Thank you, Will.
Thank you, Will.
One of the things Will did talk about was mortgages. And Representative Frantz, you mentioned this earlier, as you drive by through your neighborhoods, and I'm sure in each of your districts, as you drive by neighborhoods and see empty houses or homes that aren't being purchased, the student loan debt that people have affects that market. It's not a direct connection, but it does affect that market. And it's just something to think about as you drive through your districts. Keep that in mind. Shifting gears and kind of going to the other end of the spectrum, Skip Humphrey from the Office of Older Americans is here to talk to us a little bit about that.
Thank you very much, Jerry.
Absolutely.
And, Madam Chair and members, I just appreciate the opportunity to visit with you, but I also appreciate your wanting to know a little bit about what the CFPB is doing and how you might be able to partner with us and how we might be able to work more closely with you on these very important matters. So I want to thank you up front. Let me see if I can be as brief as possible, and obviously I would be more than happy to respond to any questions that you have. The Office of Older Americans is one of these specified offices in consumer education and engagement. It was established out of the legislation of Dodd-Frank. And, we have a unbelievably talented, great team of seven trying to serve 50 million seniors now and growing to some 20% by 2030 of American population. So obviously we need to work closely with you in partnership in order to meet our mission and to be successful. Now that mission is basically two items. Number one, to help seniors protect against unfair, deceptive, and abusive practices. Basically to stop the scams. That's to the extent that we can help individuals avoid that, whether it's by phone call or other form of solicitation or other form of ripoff, that's number one. Number two, to help seniors make sound financial decisions as they age. And while that sounds like a nice little soundbite, the reality is when you think about it, people are living much longer. And they are trying to live as independently as they can. And so that process of dealing with complex financial decisions in an ever-evolving and more rapidly evolving marketplace is a true challenge for them. So those are the two mission points. Now, how do we come to grips with that mission and to see if we can't accomplish that mission? By what you've heard before here, developing education initiatives, researching the best practices and learning from you what works here and what works across the country, coordinating with federal and state agencies. We work with all of the other federal agencies in an effort and with many of the state agencies, certainly here with your Department of Commerce and others, and collaborating with community leaders and local organizations. Now, as I've said, we have a population base that really needs some help in this area, Elder abuse, for example, has been described as the crime of the 21st century. It's frankly a bit of a hidden crime. People are only now becoming aware of it. The reporting is still not as robust as it needs to be to understand the depth of this situation. We're talking about in 2010 over almost $3 billion that was reported as being stolen or misdirected from where it was supposed to go. Why does this happen? Because, think about it, lifelong effort, people now have the resources in their hands, in their home, in their investments, and so they're targeted. It's plain and simple that they're targeted. Now, some people would say, well, seniors are more vulnerable. Well, they're not really. These guys who are out there to take their money are very sophisticated, and they know where the money is. So that's where they go. So we need to help in that area. There's another issue related to this, and that is the question of diminished capacity. As I mentioned, as we age, we lose a little bit of that edge. Now, some of us, you know, are gliding down that slope on the green slope. Some of us, like me, are on the double diamond heading straight down. But the reality is that this is a real problem, and it involves the issues of caregiving. So that you have young people, who are the main caregivers for older people? It's their relatives, it's their kids, it's their best friends. And so that not only do the younger people have to take care of the young kids, they got to take care of the older kids and to deal with that. And so that's another challenge in financial literacy and protection that takes place. So there's a dual challenge. On the one hand, older Americans need help to handle that. And on the other hand, the ones that they rely on most closely are their friends and are their members of their family. And guess who all too often is the one that's taking advantage of that relationship and steering the money in the wrong direction? It's the kids, it's the friend, or whatever else. So we have to come to grips with all that. Well, how are we going to do that? Right now, the Office of Older Americans has a number of programs, some of which I think would work very well here, and would like to have you know about them. Number one, the Money Smart Partnership with FDIC. We partnered with our federal colleagues at the FDIC and developed a module for the well-known program of Money Smart. And that is a module to help seniors understand what the needs are and how to prevent from having them be ripped off. Secondly, another area is this managing someone else's money. So you're finally asked by your mother or father to help them. And you may be designated a power of attorney. What are the responsibilities that you have? All too often, the people that are designated that, they're doing it out of care and loving for their elders, but they don't understand the responsibilities that they have. So we've developed a series of guides in this area to help their lay guides to help people get a better handle on what their responsibilities are, what their fiduciary responsibilities are, and how best to handle these financial matters for their older family members. There's another concern. All too often, the law enforcement in the states and locally are concerned about, or the banks are concerned about, giving out information to law enforcement. And so we took a look at the Graham-Leach-Bliley Act, which is the federal privacy law, and seven different federal agencies came together and developed a letter of guidance to financial institutions, indicating to them that it is okay to share private information where you believe there is a crime that is being committed or where there is elder abuse that is going on. And so we're trying to give a little more opportunity for the financial community to help assist in this prevention of this kind of abuse. There's another program called the Professional Senior Certification and Designations Report. Now, I know all of you have financial planners, and I know that each one of you know all of those letters that follow that person's name. You know all about it. And if you do, you're far ahead of me. The reality is it's very confusing for people. They don't really know what that means. And so what do? They rely on someone who gives them a reference. We were required by Congress to give recommendations on this, to do a study and to give recommendations to both Congress and the SEC. We also included in that, went beyond and said, well, the states have an important role to play in this. And so there's a lot of information in this report that I would suggest might behoove you to take a look at and see where you are with regard to the legislation and the regulation at the state level and how it fits within the framework of the report that we gave to Congress and the SEC. And finally, we are helping to establish older American protection networks. These are organizations of local, private, nonprofit, law enforcement, public agencies coming together at the local level to help prevent this kind of elder abuse that takes place. In some states, they've organized it in an effort called FAST teams. This is the Financial Abuse Specialist Teams. And basically, they're on-the-ground teams to help people very directly when they have a problem. And so we're trying to spread that information and develop those programs all across the country. Now, going forward, I think our key to success, number one, is developing strategic partnerships with states and organizations and legislatures and others, and making sure that this happens. And most importantly, of course, to listen to your concerns, understand what goes on in this state and others, learn, collaborate together, cooperate, and to take action, to make sure that there's a signal that says to those who would abuse their elders that there is a real consequence to doing that. And I'll stop there. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Well, thank you, Mr. Humphrey. It's an honor to have you here again today. And I know the hard work and the help that you've helped us with this in this area is very greatly appreciated by us, and myself included. You know, my husband and I are 70 now, and since that must be the number, because we get phone calls every day. And, you know, I still have a landline.
Welcome to my world.
Yeah, yes. And yet, in my district, I had a couple of couples that are like 79, 80 years old who got a phone call and said, "This is your favorite grandson." And they said, "Oh, Jake?" And he said, "Yes." And she sent them $2,500 by Western Union to get him out of a jam someplace. And they'll never see that $2,500 again, and they don't have a lot of money to do that. So a 91-year-old woman, the son told me, he told her the other day to never answer to your phone because she lives in such anxiety over those phone calls. So not only do we need protections, we need also more help in this area in alleviating before we become demented. I don't want to become over-anxious. The anxiety that's filled our homes is wrong. And so those are the... And I said to the folks earlier, I almost feel like starting the Grey Panthers again and empowering those of us who are at that age, because we are sick of it, yeah. And we don't want to be taken advantage of. So I'm angry about it, and I express that to you, and I also express my concerns and my gratitude.
Well, I appreciate your comments, and the unfortunate news is that this is happening all across the country. And we do need to come to grips with it, not only locally but nationally, particularly the phone calls. I agree with you. Literally, my wife and I have said, don't answer it. Take a look at the ID, and if something doesn't pop up. So now we're anxious to answer a phone.
Yeah.
And that's tragic.
Yeah, very. Thank you for being here today.
Thank you.
Any questions of Mr. Humphrey?
It's nice for me to know that in 30 to 40 years, Skip's influence will still be around protecting me. it's that powerful. But Skip makes a good point in that, as you look in your districts, mm-hmm. if you have more than five older Americans in your district, some of them are victims of financial abuse. Mm-hmm. And you probably have more than five. And if you have young professionals in your districts, and you can think of them, they're probably looking to buy that home that's still on the market. So, and you're right. You hit it, Chairman, you hit it right on the head. It's about empowerment. And Thank you, Skip. And Patty Avery is here from our Office of Financial Empowerment. So,
thank you, Jared.
Welcome.
As Jared said, my name is Patty. Unlike Representative Fritz, it's Patty with a Y.
Okay.
And I am from the Office of Financial Empowerment, where I'm a program specialist. Our office focuses on the needs of low-income and other economically vulnerable populations. For us, that means folks who are living at or below 2 times the federal poverty level. As you know from your constituents, twice the poverty level is still a challenging financial life. It's hard to make ends meet. For us as well, families with thin credit files or no credit file at all are economically vulnerable because they have difficulty accessing credit when they need it and often when they even actually deserve it. As well, we're looking at other populations who are economically vulnerable, particularly individuals with disabilities. For us, financial empowerment lives at this intersection of an improved financial marketplace, which the CFPB is working to address at a greater level, by specifically taking on supervision of products for which there has been no federal supervision. The products that low-income and economically vulnerable people often utilize, payday loans, check cashers, remittances, other products that they use disproportionately to the rest of the population. So this broader work that the Bureau is doing to supervise these products has a direct impact on creating a safer marketplace for these consumers to live out their financial lives. But we also recognize the importance of increasing financial capability so that people know how to use the products that are available to them in a way that helps them reach their goals rather than sets them back. So for our office, we have sought to identify the most promising products, services, and delivery channels. We're also engaged in research. Right now we have a research project out that we call Financial Capability or FinCap that's looking specifically at products that seek to build credit and savings, but also add in an additional service such as financial counseling or financial coaching. And we'll be, as the Office of Financial Education is doing, we'll be releasing that research in the coming year. As well, we're working to collaborate with federal agencies that touch our populations, such as HHS, the Department of Labor, and other financial regulators, and as well working with state agencies. We had a wonderful meeting yesterday with your interagency work group on financial literacy, where we had the privilege of sitting with people and hearing from 10 agencies in your state that are already working together to incorporate financial literacy into their work with the people that they serve. And then we've taken as well a focus on intermediaries, like the office that Skip is representing. We're a small team, 7 as well, serving a population of 100 million in the United States. So we realized early on the importance of connecting to the people that we're there to serve through their already trusted intermediaries, through social services agencies, community organizations, financial institutions, government, and legal aid entities. And for that reason, I'm leading a project that specifically focuses on social services staff. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, there are now 650,000 social workers in the United States, and that number is projected to increase by 25% by 2020. They're trusted sources of information, and they serve, in many cases, dozens and even up to 100 clients on their caseload. We've taken an approach that rather than equip these often incredibly busy, sometimes overburdened staff with the role of taking on financial counseling or financial coaching, we've chosen to take an approach that would equip them to have the money talk, to introduce concepts that are related to building financial stability in their normal conversation, helping them, in effect, bake it into the work that they're already doing rather than layer it on as a separate service. We began this work with a field scan, looking around the country at existing programs, including your well-established program here in Minnesota, in which I understand now you've trained 1,700 case managers with your Four Cornerstones curriculum. So we looked at that, and we wanted to understand what's working here. And we looked around the country. We looked at 14 programs. We wanted to understand what are the barriers to integrating financial empowerment into existing social services, and we wanted to identify promising practices. In terms of the barriers to integration, when there's a lack of organizational buy-in, when organizational leadership doesn't understand the connection between financial education, financial capability, financial empowerment, and their own program outcomes, they don't understand why it's worth taking that step of providing this training to their staff and helping them integrate it. And I often explain it by saying that if you're working in a jobs program and your job is to not only secure employment but help that individual retain employment, simply understanding the role of emergency savings, having a little bit of money set aside so that if your car breaks, you can still get to work and keep your job. Having emergency savings or not having emergency savings could be the barrier to maintaining employment. Or that same individual, when you've helped them get a job, and suddenly they have to make a decision between a payroll card and another form of direct deposit, because so many jobs, especially in entry-level jobs now, require direct deposit. If the individual doesn't have a bank account and doesn't understand the fees that are associated with the payroll card, they're not in a position where they can make an informed decision that will help them make the most of those hard-earned dollars. We also found that case managers' own lack of confidence in their knowledge around these issues is a barrier. We conducted focus groups, and in speaking with the organizations that are leading these trainings around the country, they found that case managers said, "I just don't know enough," because social services workers are often very low paid themselves and are borderline low income. They certainly will often fall into that twice the poverty level that I was talking about. So we found that, and interestingly, some of them even said to us, "I don't have the moral standing to have this conversation because my own finances are a mess." You know, they're often carrying their own student loans, and they're in a profession that isn't highly paid. So we decided then, we took this information and used it to help build a training that increases their confidence, that helps them step back and take a look at their own finances, challenges them to apply this to their own lives, but then equips them to serve their clients. And with the promising practices, we found that around the country, some communities are adapting the training that they're offering, depending on the context in which people are serving. One community in particular is holding one kind of training for people who see clients only one time, and a different kind of training for people who see them repeatedly over a long period of time. We also found that where it's worked, it's been built on client-driven goals. You know, if you're like me, if somebody tells me what my goal is, I don't necessarily buy into it. But when I determine what my goal is and I set my goal and I'm given the tools to reach it, I will go all out to reach it. So we found client-driven goals were important. We also found that in these communities where these trainings were taking place, that the case managers highly valued a referral guide, a vetted, cleared referral guide, so that they knew reliable organizations and individuals to whom they could refer their clients, say, for example, for debt reduction counseling. So all that went into informing our project, Your Money, Your Goals, which is a toolkit, and we're sharing it around with you. A toolkit and training have been built to respond to the findings of this scan. So we're giving frontline social services the opportunity to assist these target populations. It's training these staff by enhancing their confidence, and it's designed to provide clear examples of how to have the money conversation. We found as well in this scan that in many communities, people said, "This information is all well and good, but I still don't know how to start that conversation because, frankly, money is very taboo." And we've also built it to be user-friendly so that it can be easily referenced by the case manager and shared with the client. It's a modular toolkit. It's not designed to be something that you have to work through one step at a time. You can go, based on the assessment, directly to the information that the client wants at that moment. I just wanted to share some of the tools that are in the toolkit. One, in the assessment module, in addition to an assessment of the case manager themselves to help them understand what they know and don't know, and a client assessment to understand where the client feels that they want to focus their attention, There's an organizational assessment that helps them understand where this fits within their existing service model. You know, if you see a client only once, you're not going to have time to go into building a savings plan or building a debt reduction plan. Maybe your focus is referring them to a free tax preparation site. Maybe it's opening the discussion about, you know, you've been talking about a lot about your child and how smart she is. Let's talk about college savings. So there are any number of ways that you can work this in. So this tool is designed to help organizations understand where this fits in their existing service model. There's also a tool to help people identify if, for example, they want to set a savings goal, to help them choose what's a safe place for my savings. Our role, because the CFPB oversees a wide range of products, our goal is not necessarily to drive them into a bank account. It's to help them understand the services that are available to them, the products that are available to them, understand the risks and benefits of each product, and help them make a decision that works for them. And that brings me to the final tool, in the module that focuses on financial services. We first want to help them clearly identify, why do I need a product? And then based on that information, then they have an evaluation guide that helps them assess what is most important to me. Because for some people, it may be that it's simply close to where I live or work. Or the fees may be their most important metric. And so this sheet enables them to shop around, enables them to ask key questions and get the answers they need to make a decision that works for them and their families. We're currently field testing this toolkit with 26 organizations around the country, including here in Minnesota, where we've already trained 90 case managers to use the toolkit and provide us feedback on what's working and what's not. Our goal is to release it next summer for use by any social services organization or any agency that would care to use it. We'll be developing Train the Trainer that will help them then equip their staff to use this tool. So I can't thank you enough for welcoming us into your meeting today, and I'm happy to answer any questions you might have on the toolkit or on the work of our office.
Well, I want to thank you. I have my neighbor of 30 years who is a financial worker at Rice County Social Services, and I hear a lot from her about how overworked, how high, like the clients. And again, I have generation recipients. I have third and fourth generation in families that need this tool, and that will be very helpful. Thank you for sharing this with us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Patty. Next, I want to introduce Rob Frank from our Office of Service Members Affairs. And a quaint little story. Rob and I used to be at the same Air Force Base, Charleston Air Force Base. Matter of fact, we worked in the same squadron building, didn't even know it until we got to CFPB. So Rob's a good friend of mine, old friend of mine, didn't even know it. But this is Rob Frank from the Office of Service Member Affairs.
Hi, good morning, Madam Chair, members of the task force. I appreciate the opportunity to tell you just a little bit about the Office of Service Member Affairs within the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Our office, led by Holly Petraeus, is there specifically actually carved out in Dodd-Frank as specific requirements to look after service members and their families. And as we define it, a service member includes somebody who wears the uniform or has worn the uniform. And so that includes our active guard, reserve, veterans, retirees, all of those in there. Because the CFPB takes care of all of Americans, why not look after these? Because there are some unique circumstances that go with somebody who wears the uniform or has before with that. So we look after those and their family members. We actually have three specific requirements in our mission. First and foremost is to educate those service members in the consumer financial world. And so what does that involve? Well, we're looking at it, you know, from cradle to grave, so to speak, within a military member's cycle and their career as they go, and what kind of training they get. So the first that they ever get, if they don't get it in school or at home, is going to be in basic military training. And so what does that involve? Well, 90% of the day they're probably being yelled at, and the other 10% they get a little education. And so we've taken a look at that and seen how we can enhance that a little bit. And we're actually expanding out and working for those service members and educating those service members during their delayed enlistment programs. So because they've got 2 weeks to 10 months of I guess, virtually idle time waiting to enter the service that we could take advantage of. So we're going to do that. We're working towards that. We're also looking at what it is that they get while they're in the service. Library of Congress is actually doing a study for us to evaluate the services, financial education programs that they have, the different levels. And this isn't about telling the DOD that they're doing bad or good or whatever. It's to figure out how, as the CFPB, we can enhance their ability to provide the right kind of information at the right time to our service members. And then, of course, it doesn't end there. When somebody takes the uniform off, they continue to have needs in the consumer financial world, so we're looking at veterans and how we can help them. We have curriculum in our transition assistance program, and is a requirement when somebody leaves the service that they go through TAP, so we've developed some curriculum. But it can't stop there, because I'll tell you, just retired from the Air Force after 25 years. I went through TAP recently, and I think I was more concerned with what I was going to wear during my job interview than I was necessarily on my budget, an important aspect, but how can we follow that up? So we are working on a financial coaching initiative, where we're going to put financial coaches in the American Job Centers and our Veterans Centers to help our veterans after they've left the service on specific financial needs and situations. So we're working hard in that life cycle, in that realm. The second part of our mission is to monitor the complaints of our service members. And again, we're looking at those that are wearing the uniform or have worn the uniform. We actually have the ability, when somebody submits a complaint on our website, that they can indicate that they're a service member. It gives us the ability to look at that as a specific demographic because, frankly, there are things that are different for somebody and they're a different target. If somebody is wearing the uniform and are active duty, they have the Military Lending Act that applies to them. You have Service Member Civil Relief Act. You have some other things. You have, which we don't necessarily supervise, but they are issues that are unique to our military members. And then, of course, they have a very regular income stream, and there are people that are very willing to part people from that money. And we just want it to be a fair practice when they do that. And so we are looking at those specific issues for those in their uniform. But I will tell you, in the veteran space, it's very unique as well, because quite often they either have some income stream, whether it's a retirement or that they have some sort of veteran benefits that come to them, steady government paycheck. And again, there are some issues that go with that. I have provided you a handout of the prominent veteran issues that we are seeing out in that space, the big things that are going on with that. So I hope you take a look, and it helps you in shaping the things that you do with your veterans. As you probably are aware, there are a large group of veterans in our communities, 22 million veterans across the United States, nearly 400,000 in the state of Minnesota, and it is going to grow. Every year we add 250,000 veterans back to our communities, and in the next 5 years we're going to add an additional 1.5 million veterans. And so it's important that we take a look at how we can care for these veterans in this consumer financial workspace. And so we monitor those complaints, and we're able to look at the uniqueness, things that are targeting those specific populations, and help to curb the issues that go along with that. And then finally, the most important piece we do is work with our state and federal agencies and our other partnerships out there, whether it's nonprofits, veteran service organizations, to help veterans and to learn what the issues are out there. You know, quite often we can look at our complaint system and the feedback we get through that, but there are plenty of other issues out there that we really need help finding out what they are. And so it may be working with the state attorney general or legislative affairs or legislators within the state, veteran service organizations that are out there, to find out what the issues are and how we can best help them with that. And so we have a lot going on within our office, not nearly as many folks as our older Americans or financial empowerment, but we're gaining ground, right? But seriously, we hope to help our population in a variety of ways, and certainly could use your help in getting our word out and finding out what the issues are. And so that's a little bit about our office. I'm more than happy to answer any questions that you may have about us, but I'd also like to talk reaffirm some of our resources we have, because that's one of the things people go, well, great, you're working on a lot of things. What is it that can help us? Well, we have three very key resources that are helpful. The two of them have been mentioned already, and one will be discussed in detail in a moment. But one of them is Ask CFPB. I can't speak enough about how helpful that is to folks to be able to go in and find out some information. You know, for instance, I want to know, what website can I go to get my free credit report? If you type in the wrong address, you're going to end up paying some money. And so where can you go? Ask CFPB. We'll tell you the right answer. You have some issues that you need to have resolved with your on your credit report. There's something that's wrong there. How do you do it? Who do you go to? Do you send a letter? Do you submit something via the internet? Ask CFPB. We'll tell you. Matter of fact, we have over 1,000 items, different demographics, whether it's a student, service member, veteran, you name it. There are a lot of questions out there. And if what you need is not there, you can submit it, and we'll work through it and add it as appropriate. The second one we have is a feature called Tell Your Story. And Tell Your Story is a very important way for somebody to tell us, good or bad, what kind of things are going on in the consumer financial marketplace out there. And I will tell you that it is a very important part of what we do, and it's a great way for us to get information in our system and looked at. Every one of those submittals is looked at by a live person. And so we're able to evaluate. And some very important things have come out of single submissions under Tell Your Story. And then finally, our complaint process that my colleague, Darian, will talk about here in a moment. I think you'll find it's very unique and very impactful for our folks out in America. Mm.
Thank you.
Well, so we've heard from a couple different offices that speak directly to your districts, and that's our Office of Service Members Affairs, Office for Older Americans, and Office for Students. And you have these constituents in your districts, and these offices are here to help you help your district. That's what they're really here for. And, you know, over the broader reach of how they do that is to help empower and educate people in your districts. And one of the ways we reach out directly to the citizens in your district is through our Office of Consumer Response. And Darian, are you on the phone?
I am.
Excellent. Do you mind if I plug 311 before I hand it over? I'm going to take that as a yes. So one of the ways we my office, the Office of Intergovernmental Affairs, reaches out directly to your districts is if you have a city in your district with a 311 system or a county in your district with a 211 system, we can partner with that 311 or 211 system and our Office of Consumer Response. We can partner so that in one phone call, the people in your district can reach not only the local government but the federal government. And so there's a unique partnership availability there, a unique opportunity to really offer more services. Now, 311 is usually for potholes, if a water main breaks, or if a street light's out. But now, in your cities and in your counties and your district, if you have a problem with student loans, call 311. If you have a problem with your mortgage, call 311. If you're being harassed by a debt collector, call 311, call 211, call the city, call the county. And that will, in that partnership, that connects your citizens directly to our Office of Consumer Response. And to talk in great detail and about the Office of Consumer Response and really what they do, Darian, are you on the line still? I hope so.
Darian? Are you there?
I am here, but it's not... Hello?
Can you hear us?
Yes.
Okay. You're good.
You can hear me now?
Yes.
I feel like I'm watching a commercial, but yes, I'm here. My name is Darian Dorsey. I'm with the Office of Consumer Response. And I want to talk a little bit, in addition to all the wonderful tools that each of my colleagues have laid out in terms of financial sort of immediate direct consumer assistance that we really offer to the Office of Consumer Response. So in the most simple terms, if you think about what do we do in the Office of Consumer Response, answer questions, handle complaints, share data. So in really simple terms, that's what we do. And our vision for doing that is to be a destination for insight, for individual assistance, and for market-wide information on the consumer financial experience. So we do all of this. We handle complaints and answer questions and share data to level the playing field and empower consumers to take more control over their financial lives. So very in line with the overall Bureau mission. And we worked with our staff to really decide what are our team's values as we do this work. And those are integrity, transparency, impact, and passion. It's really important when consumers do reach out to the government or to anyone to talk about their financial issues, that they feel that compassion. They feel like, you know, someone's really listening, and that's really important to us, and it's key to kind of how we approach our work and being accessible. I'll touch on a little bit of how we do each of these, but really go into the complaints in particular, because I think that's a useful research for your constituents and for all kind of consumers. The first thing is how we answer questions. Everyone has touched on, I think, in a couple points in the presentation about Ask the FPB, and that's that online resource, which is a wonderful tool, a lot of really good, neutrally presented, authoritative answers to questions that consumers may have. But we also understand, and from day one of really understanding consumer and studying consumer response, that we really need to be accessible to all consumers, and many will use the web, but many won't. Those with low literacy or just not comfortable with web or just want to talk to a real person. So you can get the same information that's available on the web is also available by calling us at the number that's at the very top of our website. It's in no way buried. We're happy to take the calls. We want the calls. And we can answer those same questions, and we can connect to, in addition to Spanish and English, they're just kind of there and available at the contact centers. We also have the ability to link consumers to translators in more than 180 languages. So it's very important, again, for us to be accessible in addition to services for others with kind of special needs and accommodations. We work really hard to make sure we can answer everyone's question and kind of however they need it answered. We have sort of a similar approach to how we receive complaints. So that same phone number is the same place where a consumer can call, and maybe they have a question, and then they realize they have a complaint in the course of the conversation, or vice versa. Maybe they think they have a complaint, and in the course of it, they actually are like, oh, you've answered some questions. That's kind of all I had. So that same phone number is a place where consumers can get answers and can submit complaints. We also really encourage consumers to submit complaints through the website. So I've put the link here at the bottom of the slide, but consumerfinance.gov/complaint. Very easy to kind of share, and that's the whole idea. And we also encourage and are working with others to put that link on their website. So if consumers are coming to you, great. Like, send them to us, and we can kind of answer those questions. And that information is all at the bottom of the slide, and it includes kind of our operating hours and things for that phone number. The key thing with submit a complaint and being on that part is also when you use the web form, you have the ability to add attachments, and we get a lot of information that enables us to move very, very quickly. So that's just, you know, one of the advantages of the submitting over the web, but you have the option of also calling and submitting a complaint. So what is a complaint? A complaint is, there's a long kind of legal definition here. I'll leave you to read that. But at the end of the day, what it really is a consumer is dissatisfied with something that happened with a company that they do business with around a financial product or service. And we don't apply, you know, a whole bunch of things to eliminate those. We just say this is what a complaint is, and we take those and we work through a process to help consumers get responses to those complaints. So the types of complaints we accept, it's important to kind of know what we take, what's in that bucket of financial products and services. And you'll see here on the slide that's up the sort of timeline of how we've rolled these out. This is really important when you're a brand new government agency that you're not trying to do everything on day one. So we were really thought long and hard about how we would roll out the complaint handling capability so that we could do a good job and learn from each successive launch of a product or a different, you know, handling of a different type of complaint so that we could roll each thing we learned from each experience into making a better and better and better experience for consumers. So you'll see here we started with credit cards, we moved to mortgages, we kind of picked up all the bank account and service through savings, accounts and checking accounts, as well as private student loans and consumer loans, all before the middle of 2012. And then we added credit reporting later that year. And then the ability, this year we've added the ability to accept money transfer complaints, debt collection complaints, and most recently, just over a month ago, payday complaints. So as of November 1st, through this rollout, we've handled approximately 238,200 consumer complaints. So when you think about that, that's a lot of complaints. And we've built our processes to support a large volume of complaints, and that sort of drives the model as well, because we do want to provide individual assistance, but you have to be smart about how you do that. So I'll talk a little bit about the complaint lifecycle, and will be available at the end if anyone has more specific questions. But it starts with the submission of a complaint. So I described it the kind of two easiest ways, which would be submitting a complaint via the website or submitting a complaint over the phone. But consumers can also, and this happens frequently, some consumers just want to write a letter. And so we accept complaints submitted in writing, so via mail or fax. And we also accept referrals from other agencies, attorneys general and other federal agencies. So regardless of how it comes in, we take that complaint and we review and route it. So we look and see, does this complaint need to be referred to someone else? So if, for example, we got a complaint about, a consumer product like a toaster oven, we're going to refer that to the Consumer Product Safety Commission. We're going to let the consumer know what's the best resource that can assist them with something if it's not something that we can really address. And then we'll take any of the complaints, though, that are about companies that we work with and that have boarded to our system. We will send those complaints to the company for response after eliminating any duplicates and doing that type of work. Companies then receive all those complaints through a secure web portal. So they can view the complaint, view attachment. They have 15 days from the date they receive the complaint to provide a response and up to 60 days to provide a final closing response. So that gives them the ability to let us know what's going on. And then if they need a little extra time, so in the case of mortgage complaints, for example, sometimes it takes a little longer than 15 days, they can let us know. But they need to provide a timely response to us by 15 days, and then and if they need more time, by 60 days. At that point, once that response comes back, that response is made available to the consumer. So the consumer can log into their own secure web portal. So if they prefer the web, they can do everything on the web. They can log in, view that response, and then let us know if they have any feedback about the response by disputing it. So if the company has addressed their concerns, and they can get on with their lives. But if they have issues with the response, they can log in or they can call us over the phone and let us know what they think about the response that the company has provided. All of that information and all the information that the company's provided and the consumers provided in the original complaint and any information they provide in terms of feedback about the response are rolled into our prioritization effort. As I indicated on the previous slide, we've handled more than 238,000 complaints. We've got an incredibly hardworking team, but they're not going to be able to do a full regulatory analysis, and they certainly wouldn't be able to do one justice if they try to do that for all 238,000 complaints. So what they do is use all of that information through the process to quickly determine which complaints to prioritize for investigation, where there may be potential violations of law or consumer harm that we think we should take a closer look at. And throughout this whole process, the key thing that we always add as a sort of additional step is the analysis and reporting. It's key to our work that we share a lot of the things that we identify in complaints. We use that in our work with consumer education and engagement, so with the Office of Older Americans, the Office of Service Member Affairs, and others in consumer education and engagement to inform their work, as well as the work of supervision and enforcement. So as they go about their work of supervising and enforcing, we are enabling them to leverage the complaints that we are receiving to inform that work. And so these become these individual insights and the individual consumer experience that can be really instructive for that work. The other thing that we do that I think is very different in terms of how we share data externally, it's here on the slide where you can go and actually look at a consumer complaint database. So in addition to kind of internal sharing, we make these complaints available in disaggregated form, so you can see each complaint as a row without any personally identifiable information. Nothing that should be used to identify the consumer, but we include information about the complaint for each complaint that we receive that a company has had an opportunity to respond to, and either the 15 days has elapsed or they've responded within 15 days. So the company can always let us know that it's not their complaint, and we'll reroute it, and those don't go in the database. But any complaint they've had the opportunity to respond to is available after 15 days or when they respond in that database. What's in there now is approximately 170,000 complaints. This was as of last week, but the database is updated nightly. So every night there are more complaints added. Currently we have all the complaints you'll see here, credit cards, mortgages, bank accounts, and services. And you can sort and export, and the idea is that this information is available for local communities, can look at just complaints from their state and try to understand what's going on, or complaints from their zip code. So if you're really interested in, you know, six or seven zip codes around a certain municipality, that information is there to see what, you know, what types of issues are consumers complaining about, as well as, you know, useful information for reporters, for the companies themselves to see how they are comparing in terms of complaints received against their peers and others, as well as researchers. So we've already seen some researchers have taken this information and combined it with other information such as census data to try to understand a little bit more about the consumer financial experience. So all this information is available, you know, down on our website, just/complaint database, free, publicly available, and we really encourage, you know, any and everyone to use it to inform their understanding. Last, I'll just throw up a couple just quick links here to kind of have everyone familiar with. How you submit complaints is our website, /complaints. You can find reports under a similarly simple URL, consumerfinance.gov/reports. So that's where all of our reports to Congress, as well as some snapshot reports we have, will be posted periodically, and as well as the consumer complaint database, which I encourage everyone to check out and let us know what you think. So with that, I'll be available for questions, but I will turn it back over to our moderator.
Jared, do you have any more comments to share?
I just want to thank you, Chairman, Madam Chairman, and Senator Pratt. We appreciate your inviting us to come speak with you and share what we do. Like I said, we're here to help you help your districts. That's our purpose. You have people in your districts that fit these profiles, that have been submitting complaints. And you can use all of these tools that we've provided, whether it's service members, military veterans in your districts, whether it's young professionals in your districts, older Americans in your districts, to help educate and empower them. And that's never a bad thing, to educate and empower the people in your district, to not only make sound, healthy financial decisions for themselves, but that also creates an economically healthy district and Minnesota. So I want to thank you. And if you have any questions for us, please don't hesitate to reach out.
Well, thank you. I want to thank you all, excuse me, for presenting here this morning. The only thing that I regret is that all of my colleagues weren't here to hear this. This is very important information, and I'm going to do an op-ed on it for my local newspapers and beginning to talk with our colleagues among ourselves and share this information right here, but also take it home. You've provided us with some very good tools. You've covered a broad spectrum of financial issues that you've all touched on, from education to veterans to the elderly to all of the people that we represent. So I'm very grateful and thank you very much for bringing this to us. And can we keep the tool book? Is that part of our... Okay, good, because there's some really good questions and information in there that we can all share. And I'll open it up to the senator or others, and if there are questions, you certainly brought a lot of information. My head is full, and I've taken many notes. So, and the tool is wonderful as well. And so thank you, Skip Humphrey, for joining us today as well. Any questions?
No, Madam Chair.
Okay. Well, I certainly, again, can't thank you enough. And yeah, this young man flew in from Washington, D.C. this morning. I hear you've been up since 2 a.m., and he has a two-week-old. So it's good to know young people are as dedicated as the rest of us. And that shows dedication. Thank you again, everyone. Thank you.
Yes, ma'am.
And we're adjourned. Wow, this is great.
Yeah. A lot of information.
Yes, ma'am. I'll make a date, okay?